your premier source for UFO information with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Oh, good evening, good afternoon, good morning, good day. Welcome to our listeners around the world to edition number 348 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Tonight, an interview recorded last Monday afternoon with UFO researcher and author Nick Redfern, a well-respected man in the UFO field and recognized as a thorough and reliable investigator. His new book hit the shelves on Tuesday of this week and has caused just a little bit of a stir amongst UFO researchers, which you can read about at the UFO updates list at virtuallystrange.net. Why pre-record the interview, you may ask? Well, Nick's publisher, Paraview Pocket Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, placed an embargo on Nick talking publicly about the contents of his book, Body Snatchers in the Desert, The Horrible Truth at the Heart of the Roswell Story, until last Tuesday, June 21st. And the embargo happened after Simon & Schuster confirmed with Nick at the beginning of the year that the book would be released back in March of this year. And so Nick and his wife booked a vacation at a no-phone beach house in Mexico starting today, days after the revised release date of the book. A no-refund vacation. And as you're probably aware, UFO books don't make their authors anywhere near the value of the time and energy that they've invested in researching and writing their books. So there was no question for them about canceling their vacation. Victor Vigiani and Dave Furlott joined me on Monday in talking with Nick Redfern, and here's how it began. Let me lead with this question off the top. So, what got you interested in the UFO phenomena?
Well, this is the ironic thing. You know, people are saying, you know, have I made a complete about turn and saying that UFOs don't exist? No, I'm certainly not. My father actually worked in the British Royal Air Force and worked on radar for a number of years. And he was involved in several incidents in the 1950s where fast-moving UFOs were tracked on radar scopes flying across the English Channel and the British North Sea. Aircraft were sent up to intercept these things. The pilots reported that the UFOs were playing kind of like a game of cat and mouse with the air crews. And eventually the air crews had to return to base purely because they were running low on fuel. This went on over the course of several nights, and the pilots reported seeing these weird objects or lights in the sky, which no one could identify and which they ruled out the Russians or anybody like that. Everybody was afterwards sworn to secrecy and told not to talk about it. And when my dad did relate the facts to me when I was about 14, this would be in the late 1970s, it kind of really impressed upon me the fact that there was a genuine phenomenon at work and that credible people trained to know what goes on in our skies were seeing these things. And so that, to this day, convinces me that there's a very real phenomenon at work. The big question is whether or not whatever this phenomenon is has ever crashed or not.
By the sounds of your book, Body Snatchers in the Desert, the ones that we always thought happened in New Mexico apparently didn't. Or did they?
Well, the point I've tried to get across, I'm firmly convinced there's a genuine UFO mystery, but I think the fact that the government recognizes it as a UFO mystery, ironically, acts as a good cover for other operations and activities as well. And I think this is what comes to play in the New Mexico incident, but that actually acts in its favor when it wants to exploit that genuine mystery for something else.
I'm sure that most people know the legend of the crash on the Foster Ranch outside of Roswell, New Mexico in 1947, because we were all weaned on that story. Mm. The incredible work that Stan Friedman did digging up the witnesses, Kevin Randall. There have been a lot of people involved in this story over the years, although it really only came out, what, in the mid-70s?
Yeah. What I've tried to tell everybody as well is the fact that, you know, I'm not turning around and saying everybody else got it completely wrong. If you actually look at what I'm saying in the book and what people like Randall and Stan Friedman are saying, there actually isn't that much difference. The only difference is the point of origin of the craft and the bodies.
I would believe that the fallout from this incident, I think, is just major. The perspective that Nick has brought to this, I would call it a paradigm shift in a way. Mm-hmm. I really would, because it's the Roswell incident has become a legend.
Yeah.
And we all, as you say, cut our teeth on it as far as research in ufology is concerned. But what I think Nick is doing here, he's adding so many dimensions to why this myth or this legend was developed and the way it was developed by the U.S. military.
Yeah.
And,
not only that, but on a lot of the incidents, it's going to bring up a lot of questions in regards to the politics of the United States.
Let's just leave it at one of the pillars of ufology turned out to be made of salt.
Good way to put it.
Well, Nick, so take us back to how you started to develop this investigation of yours.
Well, basically, Errol, it goes back to 1996, and like a lot of people, I guess, who write books and articles about UFOs, you get contacted by people who read the articles or the books. And I got contacted in the summer of 96 by a guy who had seen me on a British TV show, a BBC show called Out of This World. And he worked for the British government on immigration issues at a department called the Home Office. Bizarrely enough, he said that he had some insider information about the British government's involvement in the UFO subject and that it was linked with US government research on UFOs as well. And we actually met on Euston Railway Station in London, which is a large railway station, met for lunch down there. This was August 1996. And he told me that basically he'd been briefed on an operation where the American government had approached elements of the British government in the post-publication era of the Charles Berlitz William Moore book, The Roswell Incident, which is the first book on Roswell. He said that essentially there was concern on the part of the US government that the truth about Roswell, whatever it was beginning to leak out. And that by monitoring the telephone conversations of various US researchers, it had been determined that they were speaking with opposite numbers in the UK, you know, trying to find out what the truth was about Roswell, or could anybody in Britain help to get the story out in the magazines, etc. And America wanted the help of the British government in basically keeping people under surveillance in Britain as to who might have been told elements of this story and knew more about it. He said that the British government agreed to basically monitor a wide range of people within the British UFO research community because they just simply didn't know back in 1980 if the whole story about Roswell was going to just blow wide open in a few months, and so they wanted to try and stay on top of it. He said that the deeper and deeper the British government got into it, the more and more suspicious they got about what they were being told by the Americans, that they actually felt that, yes, there was something big that the Americans wanted hiding about Roswell, but that it actually had nothing to do with aliens. And he said that the Americans presented the British with a whole range of materials explaining why a UFO did crash at Roswell and why the story had to be hidden. And he said this involved a number of documents and even film footage that sounded suspiciously like the so-called alien autopsy film. The further the British dug into it, the more and more they suspected that these documents were bogus and the film footage was bogus. And that, yes, the Americans wanted the British government's help in hiding the story, but equally they weren't entrusting the British in the true story. He related this to me in 1996, and I was kind of suspicious because, obviously, you know, he was someone in a key specific position, and it wouldn't be that difficult for people in the government to locate him or recognize who he was if he spoke publicly or even under a pseudonym or whatever. I addressed this in a number of interviews and in the book as well, and my conclusion was that the British government wanted the story getting out that, yes, they suspected they weren't being told the full picture, but on the other hand, they equally wanted to have some sort of plausible denial if the story did get out, if you like. And so I was told this story in 1996, and he said that the digging by the British had suggested that Roswell was more connected with classified experiments that had been undertaken in the summer of 47 using Japanese prisoners of war. And it was one of these interesting tales that was told to me that, you know, a lot of us within the UFO subject get, and I really didn't do anything with it other than put it on file until 2001 when I heard a similar story after I moved over to the States.
I would believe that the fallout from this incident, I think, is just major. The perspective that Nick has brought to this, I would call it a paradigm shift in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I really would, because it's the Roswell incident has become a legend.
Yeah.
And we all, as you say, cut our teeth on it as far as research in ufology is concerned. But what I think Nick is doing here, he's adding so many dimensions to why this myth or this legend was developed and the way it was developed by the U.S. military.
Yeah.
And,
not only that, but on a lot of the incidents, it's going to bring up a lot of questions in regards to the,
no
politics
kidding.
Of the United States.
Let's just leave it at one of the pillars of ufology turned out to be made of salt.
Good way to put it.
Oh, Nick, so take us back to how you started to develop this investigation of yours.
Well, basically, Errol, it goes back to 1996, and like a lot of people, I guess, who write books and articles about UFOs, you get contacted by people who read the articles or the books. And I got contacted in the summer of 96 by a guy who had seen me on a British TV show, a BBC show called Out of This World. And he worked for the British government on immigration issues at a department called the Home Office. Bizarrely enough, he said that he had some insider information about the British government's involvement in the UFO subject and that it was linked with US government research on UFOs as well. And we actually met on Euston Railway Station in London, which is a large railway station, met for lunch down there. This was August 1996. And he told me that basically he'd been briefed on an operation where the American government had approached elements of the British government in the post-publication era of the Charles Berlitz William Moore book, The Roswell Incident, which is the first book on Roswell. He said that essentially there was concern on the part of the US government that the truth about Roswell, whatever it was beginning to leak out. And that by monitoring the telephone conversations of various US researchers, it had been determined that they were speaking with opposite numbers in the UK, you know, trying to find out what the truth was about Roswell, or could anybody in Britain help to get the story out in the magazines, etc. And America wanted the help of the British government in basically keeping people under surveillance in Britain as to who might have been told elements of this story and knew more about it. He said that the British government agreed to basically monitor a wide range of people within the British UFO research community because they just simply didn't know back in 1980 if the whole story about Roswell was going to just blow wide open in a few months, and so they wanted to try and stay on top of it. He said that the deeper and deeper the British government got into it, the more and more suspicious they got about what they were being told by the Americans, that they actually felt that, yes, there was something big that the Americans wanted hiding about Roswell, but that it actually had nothing to do with aliens. And he said that the Americans presented the British with a whole range of materials explaining why a UFO did crash at Roswell and why the story had to be hidden. And he said this involved a number of documents and even film footage that sounded suspiciously like the so-called alien autopsy film. The further the British dug into it, the more and more they suspected that these documents were bogus and the film footage was bogus. And that, yes, the Americans wanted the British government's help in hiding the story, but equally they weren't entrusting the British in the true story. He related this to me in 1996, and I was kind of suspicious because, obviously, you know, he was someone in a key specific position, and it wouldn't be that difficult for people in the government to locate him or recognize who he was if he spoke publicly or even under a pseudonym or whatever. I addressed this in a number of interviews and in the book as well, and my conclusion was that the British government wanted the story getting out that, yes, they suspected they weren't being told the full picture, but on the other hand, they equally wanted to have some sort of plausible denial if the story did get out, if you like. And so I was told this story in 1996, and he said that the digging by the British had suggested that Roswell was more connected with classified experiments that had been undertaken in the summer of 47 using Japanese prisoners of war. And it was one of these interesting tales that was told to me that, you know, a lot of us within the UFO subject get, and I really didn't do anything with it other than put it on file until 2001 when I heard a similar story after I moved over to the States. The reason I didn't publish it was purely because the guy was presenting himself essentially as a whistleblower, if you like, but because of the unique nature of the story that he told me, if I published it, I'm pretty sure that if it was genuine, as I believe it was, that people within government that knew the story would instantly know who he was, because so few people would have been briefed on this to recognize who he was. I thought to myself, well, if he's presenting himself as a whistleblower, why is he being so careless about not caring, you know, if he's identities recognized, even on the inside, if not by outsiders. And that's why I felt that there was possibly official sanction on the part of the government, or maybe unofficially, for him to reveal his story. So if the big story did come out, then the British could say, well, you know, we kind of leaked this story all along that we didn't think it was anything to do with UFOs, and we didn't want to be seen to be supporting hiding experiments on prisoners of war. And so what I did was to file it away and just kind of dig quietly into the story. And I didn't actually find that much to back it up until I came over to the States, as I said, in 2001. And I guess purely due to synchronicity more than anything else, heard this very similar story from a woman who worked at Oak Ridge in the late 40s.
What's interesting is the way that you heard from the woman at Oak Ridge in the 40s. You were scheduled to speak at a MUFON conference in Los Angeles.
Yeah, what happened was, in my 1999 book, The FBI Files, I included a chapter on FBI files on UFO sightings at Oak Ridge from around about 48 through to about 51. And the lady contacted me and asked if she could meet me after the meeting. We actually met for breakfast the following morning. And because she'd worked at Oak Ridge, I naturally presumed that what she wanted to speak about was the material I got in the book. She was going to say something like, oh, I remember those sightings, or I remember that FBI agent coming to interview my boss. But it actually turned out she wanted to talk about something completely different. And that was the fact that she said, well, yes, we had UFO sightings at Oak Ridge, and yes, there was a lot of UFO connections at Oak Ridge, but she said, you actually got the story wrong. And then she began to relate to me how she'd worked on a number of operations which were kind of centered around determining the effects of high altitude exposure on human beings. And in the previous year, 46, an operation being set up called the Nuclear Energy for Propulsion of Aircraft program, or the NEPA program. And this was designed to see if the Americans could actually design and build successfully a nuclear-powered aircraft. And it was a project that really didn't work too well, but in the early stages, there was a lot of simulated operations. I'll give you a perfect example. The NEPA people actually commandeered a B-17 bomber and loaded the bomb bay with radioactive materials and asked the crew to sit in the cockpit with shielding materials to see how long it took them to be exposed.
Oh, my God.
To the radiation. And that actually happened. So we're not talking about some sort of futuristic prototype atomic engine. We're actually talking about simulations because the technology just simply didn't exist. And she told me that a whole range of experiments were undertaken using captured Japanese prisoners of war and also Japanese people liberated, I guess is the wrong term, but from an organization called Unit 731.
Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, Unit 731 were a really diabolical unit in the sense that they exposed people to a whole range of different experiments, infecting them with viruses and plagues, and amputating the arm off one person and trying to graft it to another person purely just to see what the effect would be.
A lot of them, I guess, were physically disabled to start with.
Yeah, what happened was there was a combination of people. They actually did some experiments on captured Allied troops. Some of them were Chinese people. Some of them were handicapped people actually taken from remote Chinese villages where inbreeding had been rife and all sorts of syndromes and conditions been spread across the generations to where some of these people looked unusual and had a wide range of physical and mental handicaps.
I think it's fair to say, too, Nick, that this is not speculation on your part. This is not something that should or may not be believed by someone listening to what you're saying. This, in fact, did happen.
Yeah, these are documented.
Yeah.
You do a search on Amazon, even, for Unit 731. There are several books being written
about
the subject, and there are files at the National Archives. Some of the people they experimented on were handicapped Japanese people, literally taken from hospitals because they're actually, at the time, perceived as, you know, we'll just use these people because nobody else cares about them. They're just, you know, locked away in a hospital ward or whatever. And three of the key conditions, one that the people told me was involved with these operations, a condition called progeria, and also Werner's syndrome, which is progeria of the adult. And in both of these conditions, a person has an adult height of literally about 4 to 5 feet and very often an enlarged head, no body hair, and occasionally polydactylism, which is an extra finger, which is something that occurs in a lot of these syndromes. And so the people looked unusual. And Unit 731 was looking at ways of attacking the United States, and they had plans to launch aircraft, fly them across the Pacific, and attack cities like San Diego and San Francisco with plagues, and literally release plague-infected fleas and flies, which would then literally fly down and bite people and spread plague viruses throughout the cities. Coincidentally, and this is what leads to, if you like, the genesis of the Roswell event, is that at the same time that the Unit 731 people were undertaking these bacteriological and biological warfare operations on people, there was another division of the Japanese military that was building these balloons called Fugo balloons that were designed to be flown across the Pacific to the States. And they actually weren't that advanced, but they were kind of ingenious in the sense that they were balloons about 30 feet in diameter that would have a bomb attached below them. And they would have this calibration device attached to them where the closer they got to the United States, the calibration device would lower and lower them in the sky to the point where it was planned and estimated so that hopefully when they would finally hit the ground, they would land on American soil rather than 50 miles out in the Pacific or whatever. And one of the plans that the post-Fugo projects was to load these Fugo balloons with bacteriological warfare materials generated and created by the Unit 731 people. So you had these people working on diabolical human experiments, and you had this other unit working on advanced balloon projects. They would have come together if it hadn't been for the fact that the war had ended.
So you have, Nick, Unit 731, and you have the Fugo balloon unit contemplating working together to spread plague. How does that tie into what was thought to have happened at Roswell, New Mexico?
Well, if you go back and look at U.S. newspaper archives from 1945, had the Second World War not ended with the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese actually had plans to launch far more destructive balloon launches against the U.S. And whereas the original Fugo balloons were sort of 30 feet diameter, fairly flimsy balloons, but destructive because they had these bombs below them, the Japanese were actually planning to build these far larger, more powerful balloon and stronger balloon systems, which would have a gondola attached below them, which basically the plan was again for them to be lifted very high into the sky and carried by the winds across the Pacific over to the US. Now, of course, the crew wouldn't have any way to control these things, but it would just be the case that when they reached the US mainland, and hopefully in the vicinity of a city, they could then disperse bacteriological warfare into the skies and unleash it across, you know, in a worst-case scenario, a populated city. And newspapers of the time actually talk about how, because of weight and provisions being a premium, that food was required and pressurization. So these were kind of really advanced gondolas that they were planning. And newspapers actually talk about death-defying Japanese personnel, to quote them exactly, manning the balloons. And then you have the fact that these guys were all planned to be little guys, you know, literally 5 feet tall, not handicapped people, just pilots trained to fly these things of a small stature, purely because weight and height and, you know, provision for food and water were kept to a minimum. This was actually all in planning stage in August 45, literally weeks before the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, of course, that all came to an end. Post this period, you had the deals made with the Nazi scientists, Operation Paperclip, to bring a whole range of German scientists over to the U.S., people like Hubertus Strughold and Werner von Braun, to conduct rocket experiments, aircraft experiments, that sort of thing. What's less well known is that a similar deal was made with a lot of the scientific elite of Japan, including some of the people involved in the human experiments and also some of the people involved in the balloon experiments. When the Americans got their hands on all the Japanese files, basically they told the Japanese people that when they captured them, you know, you either work for us or work with us, or you'll be tried for war crimes and executed. Some of them simply wouldn't work with them. You know, they were proud and didn't want to admit to defeat. Others did and gave up some of their colleagues. And to the, I guess, concern and dismay of the Americans, they found blueprints for some of these highly advanced and novel plans where they took it even a stage further from having these advanced balloons and gondolas. And instead, what they actually had were huge balloon systems Whereas with the old gondolas, the pilots obviously would have no way of controlling where the balloon would go. They would just hope for the best and release this material, and you know, that there was no way they would be able to get back to Japan. But they came up with this other plan to kind of build a structure essentially similar, but obviously much smaller, to the structure that supported the Apollo rocket that went to the moon. And you would have a balloon held rigid by this structure, and below it, or a balloon array, and below it there would be this delta wing aircraft, kind of like a Horton-inspired aircraft, like a
flying wing.
Yeah.
And I need to interrupt again because we have to break. The Americans bring over the two Japanese units, the Fugo balloon unit and Unit 731, the medical experimentation unit, under the threat of killing them if they don't cooperate, and install them where?
All the evidence seems to suggest that the people, at least some of those that were brought over, were taken to a hospital in Chicago, which I'm not entirely sure where that was. The thing I've stressed in the book is if everybody telling the story almost like parrot fashion, I'd be very suspicious, you know, that they're all being briefed on what to say. But everybody's got their own angles based upon what they knew about this particular story.
Uh-huh.
But at least as far as the people are concerned, it seems some were taken to Chicago, and the material evidence and the plans and the blueprints were taken to the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico.
When you say the people, you're talking about the victims of Unit 731?
Yes. Yeah, Unit 731 people taken to Chicago, but the personnel, the pilots and the crews involved in utilizing these craft and so on, the balloon and the Horton-inspired vehicles, they were all taken to White Sands, or at least to New Mexico, and then flown to White Sands when the experiments were ready to begin.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, going back to those Fugo balloons, the concept of floating those balloons over to the United States in a gondola and the manned gondola, so to speak, back in the early 30s, the Graf Zeppelin proved that it could cross the Pacific with no trouble whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Basically, we're talking 2 to 3 days. Germans would have shared that particular technology with the Japanese. Mm-hmm. Would they not have understood how to basically bring a balloon across in 2 or 3 days, minimizing the amount of food? I understand the whole idea that it's going to require some food and stuff for the crew, but, you know, making sure that the particular crew has to be 5 feet or less because the gondola is food requirements sounds a little strange to me.
The main explanation I got from that was that if you look at the things like the, you know, the larger balloons, the ones you're talking about, they're actually quite big. But the ones that they were talking about in the U.S. newspapers, that the balloon itself was only 50 to 60 feet diameter that they were talking about sending across, purely because they didn't want the thing to be seen. You fly something the size of the Hindenburg, then, you know, a 6-foot-tall person, there'd be no problem having provisions for them, purely because of the size of the balloon, etc. But what they're actually talking about was trying to keep the balloon sizes to a minimum to maximize the fact that they wouldn't be seen or tracked on radar, even as rudimentary as radar was back then. But also, because the balloons would have to be small, the gondolas would have to be small, so the knock-on effect was that everything was small, was the way it's related. You know, we weren't talking about huge balloons 50 or 100, 200 feet long, you know, kind of like airship-type balloons. We're just literally smaller balloons and keeping everything to a minimum.
Well, thank you for that. That's a clarifier, because it was always a puzzle for me, too, as to what size these things were.
No, they weren't large at all. It was just the purpose that they were being used for was more unique than the size of them.
So the plan was for kamikaze crews, presumably, on
these things? Yeah,
there
would be no way for these people to get back. It literally was a case of having people on board, not so much even as pilots, because with the Fugo balloons, they knew how to get these things to the States. They knew how to calibrate them in terms of, so they would get lower and lower in the sky as they reached the U.S. coastline. The plan simply was that if in the event that in an unmanned situation, the balloon just crashed in a forest somewhere and nobody ever knew it and the materials wasn't released, at least if there were people on board, then they could actually actively and personally release the biological warfare materials themselves, even though there was, you know, no way for them to get back.
Now, to come back to 1947 and White Sands, New Mexico, did the Americans put 731 and the Fugo balloon unit together?
Yes. The important point to stress is that the 731 people and the Fugo balloon people are actually working together in Japan to launch these destructive balloons. The Fugo balloons and the gondolas were being built by the Fugo people, but the biological warfare dispersal materials, that was coming from 731. So the two projects came together even before they reached the state.
Well, once installed in White Sands, New Mexico, then what?
Well, what happened, and again, this is based upon the testimony of the people I've interviewed for the book, is that the Americans were intrigued by the fact of trying to launch a vehicle into the air by balloon. And I actually don't go into this too greatly in the book, but one of the people I interviewed told me that the reason this was done was because if you consider that the post-war era with atomic weapons and things like this, you know, warfare was going to be a very different environment. Mm-hmm. And if you imagine that most Air Force bases, aircraft need runways to take off. If hugely destructive bombers destroyed the runway, how do you get something into the air? One of the things they were looking at was trying to get a vertical takeoff vehicle that if a runway was destroyed, it wouldn't matter because it could take off vertically. And this was when helicopters were sort of in its infancy and vertical takeoff aircraft simply didn't exist. And they thought, well, is it possible, you know, we could use this kind of plan that the Japanese had where we could have a vertical takeoff aircraft which would go high in the sky because it would just simply pulled vertically up by balloon and then it would detach itself. You could use it that way. And as all the people told me, that this was just kind of a very bizarre program which actually cancelled in August 47 precisely because it was, as you can imagine, kind of unwieldy and very precarious in the air. But the story I got was that they built this structure in which the balloon array was held with this vehicle below it, and then they would slowly move the structure to one side, and the balloon array and the aircraft, instead of a gondola below it, would lift up into the air, and after a certain amount of time, the crew would be able to detach the vehicle, which was this kind of swept back delta wing, kind of like a cross between a flying wing and the stealth bomber type vehicle, would detach from the balloon array. And the plan was simply just to get it up in the air and then release it and have it land back at White Sands and see if it worked. Obviously, by all accounts, it didn't work, and it was just one of these weird projects that they investigated to see if it was viable and then just decided that it just didn't work well. It was just too cumbersome and too unwieldy.
What led them to believe that it wouldn't work?
Well, purely the fact that, you know, if you imagine you've got this huge balloon system made up of a number of balloons, and this device attached beneath it, which was held rigidly, but until you actually get in the air, the crew, of course, have got no way to determine where it's going to go.
Right.
It's just when they actually detach the aircraft that they're able to potentially glide it down. Or actually, one of the other plans as well, to have like a powered glider as well. The plan was to use one of these devices, but fit it with propeller-driven engine as well, which at least would allow them to kickstart it and fly it down.
Yeah.
But
Nick, we need to break.